Okay, we are into the hour and we have a lot of material tonight. So welcome all. If anybody wants to join the OPCUG, if you're not a member already, if you check the chat, there is a link in there where you can go to join the group. However, we do welcome guests, so feel free to continue as a guest if you want. And with that, I'll turn it right over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Soon as you've muted all, I imagine.
Oh, sorry, yes. Well, mute all. And everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so. If you have a comment or question, please remute yourself afterwards so we don't have too much background noise. And the contents of the chat, the deck, and the audio will be up on the website probably later on this evening. Over to you, Alan.
Okay, thanks, Chris. As Chris noted, we have a lot of material tonight, and I think it's quite interesting, so let's get right to it. First of all, a follow-up on our Fraud Watch item. Chris and I received this email, I think, last week, and the question is, are there any red flags here? I guess the first thing I noticed was the bank sending this message, it's a new massage. They're either sending us a new massage or they're offering a new massage. I'm not quite sure. And then the other thing you notice is that they've locked our card as a precautionary measure. And we've only got 7 days or we're going to have to renew it for a fee, which sounds a bit like hurry up and press this big blue button right here. But you clearly this is a legitimate message from the Royal Bank of Canada. It's even from their website here, see, rbcroyalbank.com at schwiley.com. Maybe there are one or two red flags here. It's probably not unreasonable that the bank would send the treasurer and the president a message. The only problem is the club doesn't have an account with the Royal Bank of Canada. So I think that tells us a story right there. Okay, moving along, you recall that I had this issue with plugging my backup USB flash drive into my computer, and I'm getting this as a problem with this drive, and Chris had suggested that maybe a dirty bit could be set. So this time, when it happened, I tried running this FS utility dirty bit query. And it says, yes, indeed, your flash drive is definitely dirty. So I ran check disk and it scanned the disk and couldn't find any problem. So the dirty bit was set, but I'm still no wiser why and how and what the issue might be. Okay, an update on Fongo. If you use a smartphone and you're running out of minutes or you have a pay-as-you-go phone, and you need to call Bell Canada and they keep you on hold for an hour, you can soon chew up a whole pile of money at 40 cents a minute. So one of the things you can do is use Fongo, which is a free talk app across Canada, basically. And you get, by signing up, you get a local Canadian phone number, and that's local set by Fongo. You don't get to choose that. But you do get unlimited calling, you get incoming calls, you get text messages. And you can also talk free and text free to anybody else who's using Fongo. However, if you want to send text regularly, then you have to buy some time. And the same with international calls. They have really cheap rates for a lot of different countries, but you need to buy some calling credits to be able to use that. One of the neat features is if you take your phone out of the country, you can call back to Canada for free on your local Canadian number. And it has some features like caller ID and that kind of stuff. However, one of the things I found when I was using it at first was the call quality and especially the stability wasn't always the greatest. It was frequently hanging up on me. However, if you want to try that, it's a free app, so it's worthwhile taking a look at that. And Jeff Dubois added some notes to my thoughts there. He notes that it's available on Apple Store, Google Play, Amazon Store, and even from Huawei and Samsung and Microsoft. So It's available for a lot of different devices. And Jeff says he believes it has the ability to receive facts and store it as PDF, and or store PDFs in the voicemail directory. He hasn't tried that. Now, there's a home phone option for almost $5 a month. It gives you unlimited calls, and maybe you need to buy an ATA for an extra $30. And there's a voice to text option which lets messages be forwarded by email. And there used to be a free freephoneline.ca, which was a sister company of Fongo, which let you use your PC as a home phone line, but they seem to have eliminated that feature. But the website still exists, so if you were a previous customer, then I guess things are still working for you. Okay, moving along, we have an item here from Linda.
Okay, thanks, Alan. So as you all know, I write a monthly photography column for OPCUG, so I'm assuming that there are people in the club that are interested in photography. So I just wanted to do a little plug for the Orleans Photo Club that Chris and I belong to. It's been kicking around for a while, established in 2002, and right now we have about 45 members. We had over 60, but we lost about 20 or so during COVID because we switched over to Zoom and not everybody followed. We may go back to in person, but I'm not sure we'll be able to gain those members back, and we're always looking for new members. So all levels of photographers are welcome, and people are very helpful to anyone who's trying to learn at any level. Lots of people offer their assistance. We meet every month, every second Saturday at 9:30 a.m., which I like because it never conflicts with any evening events or afternoon events of the weekend. So I really like it. It goes from about 9:30 to noon. And I'm the director of competitions at the moment, and so I get to choose the topics for the monthly competitions, which is fun. And then you submit photos, or you can submit photos, you don't have to. And those photos are judged by the other members of the club. And then twice a year, we have a competition where they're judged by certified judges. A couple of judges will come in and judge them. And it's all anonymous, both the judging by peers and by the judges. And it's all done on the website for the voting. You don't have to send in any spreadsheets or anything. And we have a resources section that Chris keeps very up to date with all sorts of interesting things. And he recently, in the last few weeks, set up a forum like the OPCUG one. And it's it hasn't had a lot of uptake yet, but the people that are on it are really enjoying it and posting very good things. So I'm just showing you a picture there of Chris's where he won first place in the rock competition that I set up. And not only first place at the highest level of the club, but so far in the year, it's the top scorer. So next slide, please. So just to let you know, we have invited speakers at every meeting, and they're just stellar. They're usually well-published photographers and or professional photographers. A couple of times a year, we do have members speak, but it's usually professionals that come in to speak to us. There's multiple workshops in the year and social events and photo outings, but they're usually the costs are covered. So the club pays for the cost of the workshop that would be, you know, that the professional would charge. So we get the advantage of working with professional photographers, learning, might be composition, might be how to do still life, might be, you know, setting up lighting, whatever. All sorts of topics that they cover in these workshops. Chris is going to go to one this Saturday on lenses and other gear like that. So the other thing that's great is this club uses the column I write for OBCUG. It uses it extensively because not only does it link to it in the resources section, but I do a 5 to 10 minute photo 101 every monthly meeting, and I use these columns. So it's really great that they have a second life. So if you wanted to attend as a guest just to see if you like it, we have two more meetings, one in May and one in June, and you can just attend, as I say, as a guest and don't have to decide if you're going to become a member. And then in the fall, if you do become a member, it's $50 per year, $75 for family, which is a little more than this club, but you do get a lot of things that are covered. So like we went and did the Cumberland Christmas lights at the museum and our entry fees were covered in that. So I think it's a good deal, and I've just left the website there for anyone interested. But please flip me a note at the address there, and I'd be happy to set you up with the right people if you want to just visit for the next meeting or two. Thank you. That's it. Thanks.
Linda, if you wanted, you could paste your email address into the chat, and people could pick it up there too. I put the URL to the club already in there.
Okay, perfect.
Thanks, Linda. It's interesting to learn about our sister club. Okay, next up we have a computer basics item from Chris.
Yeah, so this is a scenario I have here, which is probably pretty common for a lot of people. If you're reading a very long document or a long web page that, you know, scrolls on and on and on, you can use the arrow keys and to move down on the page or move up, but it'll sort of jump line by line, or you can use page up, page down, or you can use a scroll bar to move around on the page, but it all requires manual actions on your part to actually move to different parts of the page. Next. Wouldn't it be nice if you could just have it scroll smoothly while you read the page? Well, you can. Next. So what you do is you just place the mouse cursor anywhere on the page. Try for near the middle, and I'll explain in a second why around the middle probably makes the most sense. Next, and then you click the mouse wheel. So you don't scroll it, you just click it, and the mouse cursor will change from the arrow to that circle with triangle above and below a dot that's in the middle. Next. Then if you move the mouse pointer higher on the page, all of a sudden the page will start smoothly scrolling. And next, if you move it down the page, or from your initial starting point, it'll change so it's the dot with the down pointing triangle, and the page will smoothly scroll downwards. Next. And you can move it farther away to make it scroll faster, or closer to your starting point to make it scroll slower. And this is just dynamically, you can just change at any time by just moving your mouse up or down to change the speed at which things are scrolling. Next. And then if you're done scrolling, you just press the escape key and it'll cancel the scrolling. So a very handy way to just, you know, start it scrolling and you read it. If you need to change the speed because it's going too fast or too slow, you can adjust it very nicely to adjust the scroll rate. Works in most documents as well as web pages and things like that. That's it.
Tom's noting that it doesn't work in Firefox.
Oh, that's curious. I'm really surprised that it doesn't.
I'm not. Firefox is a weird beast these days.
It is a little different, yeah.
No, it's like the default browser for Linux, my Linux distro, but every time it comes up for an update, it's trying to download at like 33 kilobits a second. It takes 30 minutes to do the download. Crazy.
Tom, I just tried it in Firefox and it's working for me.
There we go. Okay. All right. Thanks, Chris. Okay. So next item was a question came in about passkeys and Google's credential manager. And the individual had read about them, but he was too cautious to set up an account. Now, I don't know anything about Google's credential manager, so if anybody knows anything about that, speak up in a few minutes. I didn't actually know anything about passkeys, so I looked it up, and it basically turns out to be a version of public key cryptography. So public key cryptography is based on RSA algorithm, and it essentially uses a pair of keys, a public key and a private key, and your data that you want to send to people is encrypted with the public key, which everybody has access to, but only you with the private key can decrypt the message that is sent to you. And there's a link here which explains basically how all this stuff works. So, for example, you can see here that there's a message here with a secret word, and then it's going to get encrypted using the public key into essentially binary, which nobody can understand, or at least it doesn't translate back to the text. But if you use the private key, and you have to use the private key, then you can reconstitute the message, and you can find the top secret word, which nobody except all the people who played Adventure knows. So basically, in public key cryptography, the sender is going to encrypt the message using the public key, and only the receiver can decrypt the message using his private key. So it's clearly, you make the public key public, and that's how it works, but you have to keep control over the private key and not let anybody except you know anything about that. The other way this is used is for digital signatures. So in this case, the sender encrypts the message using the private key, and then the receiver gets this encrypted message. He can decrypt it using the public key, but because he can do that, he knows that only the sender could possibly have encrypted it. So it's a way of verifying who the sender is, that he's a valid sender. So there's a neat little video on YouTube where this guy, Rennie Ritchie, explains how all this stuff works, the private key and the public key. And the interesting thing here is that the way passkeys work is that even you don't know what the private key is. Passkeys creates both keys, but it doesn't tell you what the private key is. The device where the passkey has been produced, it knows what the private key is, and only that device knows, which is kind of interesting. So what happens is, you're trying to log into a secure website here, and the server sends you a single-use challenge. So now your device has to look at the challenge, compute and encrypt a signature to respond to the challenge, and it uses the private key on the device to create that encrypted response, and it sends it to the server. So now the server has the public key, your public key, so it now decrypts the message, and it knows that you must have sent it because you're the only person that has the private key, so you're the only person who could have responded to this message with the correct signature. And the interesting thing is that your private key can't be hacked because only the one-time signature which was required is being transmitted. It doesn't include the key. Phishing doesn't work. Nobody can send you a message and say, oh, please send me your password, but you don't know what the private key is, so you couldn't tell them even if they asked for it. And the other thing is, people can't shoulder surf you and kind of look over your shoulder when you're in the coffee shop because you're not typing anything. Everything's being handled by your device with this super secret private key. So it's kind of a neat option. So if anybody's interested in trying passkeys and wants to come back and tell us all about it, I'd be interested to learn.
The one thing that I always worry about on things like that is the ultimate denial of service attack is they steal your device. And then what do you do?
Well, you ain't logging on with it then anyway.
No.
No, that's true.
Okay. Then you remote wipe it.
Yeah, but you still lost access because you don't know what the private key is.
So you can't
log in. You mean you don't have it. Well, you have a duplicate device.
I guess you have to somehow, yeah.
Backup. Okay, so moving along. Chris has got a share for us on Microsoft Edge.
Yeah, so this I debated whether it should be a share or a computer basics, but I think this is something that perhaps a lot of people were not aware of, the fact that there are a bunch of tools that are built into the Microsoft Edge sidebar. So this is going to be of most use to people who use Microsoft Edge as their default browser. And I think that a lot of people have the browser loaded most of the time that they're on their computer. So you have all these tools available to you very easily. So there's nothing in these tools that are not available elsewhere. But it's just one nice collection of them. So you have a calculator, unit converter, translator, dictionary, and a world clock. Next. So the first thing you have to do is get the tools, and by default, they don't show up on that sidebar. Oh, by the way, if you don't have the sidebar showing, which it is by default, so if you turned it off, presumably you know how to turn it on, but if you don't have the sidebar showing in Edge, if you go to the settings in Edge and you just search on the word sidebar, it'll come up at the top where you can toggle it on, and then you'll have that sidebar going down the right-hand side of the screen. You click the plus, which if you hover over it, it has a tooltip that says Customize Sidebar. Next. And then you go down to, in the Manage section, you toggle on Tools. And as I said, by default, it'll be off. You just toggle it on. And then all of a sudden, you have an icon that appears in the sidebar. And if you hover over it, it'll say Tools. Next. And you can click the plus at that point to close that customize toolbar if you want. Next. So now we have that tools icon there. So you click on it. Next. And you'll get the tools pane open. And you'll see that there are just different sections within this. So we have the calculator at the top, a unit converter, the translator, and then we see the top of the dictionary one, and then the last tool will be scrolled down at the bottom. So next. So the calculator, real basic, just a basic calculator, so four-function calculator, no magic to it or anything like that. Next. Unit converter is pretty good. There are many different units that you can choose from, as you can see on the screen there. And the next. Oh, actually, go back on that one. Sorry, Alan. When you so the way you can get the different units is that you click on just below the what the calculated amount is. Where now it's saying length. You just click on there, and you can choose from another one. And within those, there's lots of different conversions you can do. So you can see in the length what I'm converting from is kilometers to miles. And you can put in any number you want in either of those, and it'll convert the opposite. There are lots of different conversion factors that you can actually do. So, you know, you can find that one smoot is equal to 67 inches, and, you know, there's tons and tons of conversion factors in there. So I defy people to come up with some kind of conversion that they can't do. Next. So the translator, it defaulted for me to be auto detect on it. And what you end up doing is next, you just put in, choose the language you want to translate to. And if necessary, you can actually change the translation from to a specific language if it makes a mistake in it. Next. And there are many languages. You can see the size of the scroll bar there. We've got, you know, probably about 100 languages that are available for translation. Next, you put in the text you want to translate from. So I put in how much is prime rib, and it comes back combien coûte la côte bœuf, and so it does translation for you, nice and easy. Next, and next. And then you'll see some icons down along the bottom. You can copy that text to the clipboard. With the right-hand one, that's probably the one that most people would use. You can actually search. Forget what actually the search function does. If you think the translation is bad, you can actually suggest an edit to it. And you can have it speak out the translation to you by clicking on the speaker icon. So kind of a neat little translator. Very handy. Again, anybody who's using Edge as their default browser, nice to have it right there. Next. Dictionary is the next tool. And so you just put in a word and you click on define, next. So here I put in equivocal, and it comes up with all kinds of dictionary information on it. You know, the definition, antonyms, synonyms, you know, the how it's used, uncertain and or questionable in nature. You know, it has a lot of information in there with live links to all these other words that you can then go and load them up into your browser. So kind of neat for a dictionary on there. It's quite comprehensive. Next. The next one is World Clock. And so if you go in there and you click on the Add Clock, next, You can search for a city, and a lot of cities are covered around the world. I tried some, just Zadar, Croatia was in there. Alice Springs, Australia is in there. So there are thousands and thousands of communities in there. Next. Once you find the one you want, then you click on it in the results pane. Next. And then it'll actually show it to you in the tool. So you can see what time it is. And it tells you how many hours of a shift it is too. Next. So if you want just some of the tools, you don't want all of them there, you can do that. So when you go into the tools menu, you'll see that there's a left-hand icon at the top, which if you hover over, it says open settings, and you click on that. And then it will bring up all of the five tools, and you can toggle on or off any of those tools that you want. Next. And then you can also reorder them by just clicking on one of them and drag it and drop it to a new location, and it'll be in that different order. So you can always have, you know, the most useful tool right at the top of the screen if you want. So just some handy tools. If anybody uses Edge, you might want to check them out, have them available to you when you need them. That's it.
Thanks, Chris. So Natalie says she uses a unit converter on her cell phone a lot because it's embedded in the calculator. And she doesn't use Edge, but she wondered if other browsers will add these functions. Do you know if any other browsers have that functionality?
I don't know of any others that have it, but you know, a lot of them are probably available through extensions in the browser that you could get these various things like that. But I haven't really looked around for it.
Karen says she has extensions on Chrome, and Tom has a link here for a translator with Bing, which he says is the same translator.
Yeah, and there's, of course, Google Translate is available as well as a web page. So as I say, there's nothing magical about any of these tools. They're all available. This is just one handy place that they, if again, if you're using Edge as your default browser, it's just always there. So kind of neat.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So our next item is a question that came in actually from Bob Walker, and it's about PowerPoint. And he says, is there a way to wrap text around a picture as you can in Word? And can you change the color of the text shadow? So in other words, could you have white or a yellow shadow against black text? So the answers are no, but, and yes. So basically, PowerPoint does have some text handling options. In the ribbon, you've got things like boldface and italic and shadow and that kind of stuff. But it doesn't natively support text wrapping. However, it does support that. So that's the no. It doesn't natively support text wrapping, but there's a way around it. And yes, it does support multiple colors for both text and shadows. So if we first think about text wrapping, one of the things you can do is you can cheat. And you can use a second program to create whatever effect you want and then paste that into PowerPoint. And if you remember the original Q&A logos that we've been using for quite a while, that's exactly how they were produced in PowerPoint. They're actually from, I think, a font from my LibreOffice Writer app. And then cut and pasted onto PowerPoint slides, and then eventually they went into the PowerPoint template, the original one. However, text wrapping can be actually done pretty easily using Microsoft Word. So if you've got Office, you've got PowerPoint, and you've got Word. So the way you do it is you create the wrap in Word. So here's a Word document with some text, and I'm wrapping it around the penguin icon here. And you can basically do that by hovering over the icon and pulling up this icon here, hovering over the image, pulling up this icon, and then that gives you all these various options for wrapping the text with respect to the image. So once you've done that inside Word, then you close the Windows file, the Word file, and in PowerPoint, you go to the menu and go to Insert, Text, and Object, and that brings up this Insert Object dialog box. And you use this radio button here, Create from a File, and then you browse to the doc file that you just produced in Word, and you notice it says it inserts the contents as an object into the presentation, and you can activate it using the application that created it. So now you you say OK, and bingo. Here is my slide. Here's my Word-produced object, and you can see that the text is wrapped around the icon, the image. But Chris points out this is not just a screenshot. It's not just an image. If I double-click on this, it basically opens it as a window, and you can see that this is essentially a Word document-type window. And now I can actually change the text. I can change the colors, and then that will now be the result in my PowerPoint file. So this is kind of a live, like a live sub-document, if you like, which you can play around with inside PowerPoint. Now the other thing was I said that PowerPoint does have the ability to do text, colors, and shadow colors. And basically, the rudimentary one is if you just use the shadow icon, so you've got some text here, and you can maybe see that there's a gray shadow on this text. But if I right-click on this text and choose Format Text Effects and Shadow and then Color, I can actually change the color, I can change the size, and now I've got what Bob wanted, yellow shadow on black text. And the way that works is when you right-click and get the Format Text Effects and produce and go to Shadow, then you've got all these different options. And I've chosen color is yellow. I've chosen the transparency to be 0%, so it's nice and bold. And I've made it somewhat bigger than default, so it's obvious that there's a yellow shadow on the text. But clearly you can do all kinds of other things. You've got reflections and glows and soft edges and all kinds of wonderful things. So PowerPoint is actually quite powerful in terms of things that you can do to make your presentations pretty. Okay, moving along. This is an item from Stuart Bruce, who's going to talk about this, I think. And you notice he's going to the dark side. He's switching to iOS from Android. I wasn't quite sure how we could do this, but then he noted that this particular app is available for Android, so it's okay. We'll let him talk about it at the PC users group. Are you there, Stuart?
I am eternally grateful for your kindness, O wise one. Yeah, I've switched to an iPhone for my mobile device. And since I use the mobile wallet, Google Wallet, a lot with my credit cards and loyalty cards all mixed together, I found it a little awkward to do the same thing on the iPhone with the loyalty cards. They didn't want to fit into the Apple Wallet. The Air Miles card would go in, but I had a heck of a time getting anything else to work until I found this application, Stowcard, and it works great. And it's just for loyalty cards, so you need to carry two apps on your phone, but that's easier than two wallets in your pocket. And you just scan a card, and it puts it in there. If the card is not in your in its list, you can just plug in the number for the barcode, if you still have your physical card, that is, and it will generate a barcode that and plug it into its list of cards that you're carrying around. So it'll work on iOS or Android and even Huawei phones. And The only caveat I've found is that there are some offers occasionally, little surveys to fill out. And it's a totally free app, but they have advertising. Not obtrusive advertising, but a little, you know, free offers from this store and that store. So if you can ignore that, it's a very useful little little thing to carry around.
Okay, and keep going, Stuart, because your next one is also a store app.
Sorry, guys. This is Karen. Just interrupt for a second. Can you go back to the wallet thing? I've never used a wallet. Stuart, can you talk a little bit more about what the advantages are or why you've switched to using a digital wallet?
Well, I always carry my phone, and it's a lot slimmer than my wallet. And when I take all the loyalty cards, I'm going back to the loyalty thing first. When I take all these loyalty cards out of my wallet, my money wallet, it becomes even more slender and fits better in my pocket. As far as using a digital wallet for financial transactions, you have the same security that you would using a physical credit card, for example, if you were to use one. But even better, for example, Google Wallet or Apple Wallet will block the actual card number from the vendor and generate a random number that only they know. So only you and Google or Apple or whoever you're in business with will know what the card was that you used at that store for that transaction, which adds a layer of security that you didn't have before. And it's cool.
So, Stuart, Micheline says she sees people making payments with their phone. How do you use the phone to make a payment?
It has to be a phone that has near-field communication capabilities, a radio, and that has to be turned on. And with my Android phone, all I did was load the wallet app when it came time to make the payment. Select the card I want to use if it wasn't the default card for the app, and hold it on the terminal like it was a credit card. And it worked pretty good everywhere except Metro. The Metro chain of stores would not take my Google Wallet Tangerine MasterCard. They would take the physical MasterCard. They wouldn't take the Google Wallet MasterCard. But
they don't have a wireless connection.
Too many people.
The fact that it doesn't work, does that mean that they don't have a wireless connection to your phone?
No, it just wouldn't accept the card. Say transaction failed. And then I would take my physical card and use it, and it would work. Then I would go to the store across the street and do the same thing with the phone, and it would work. So it was just that one particular chain of stores that had a problem with that one particular credit card in Google Wallet. I find with the Apple Wallet, it works seamlessly. I have no problem. So that's a Google hiccup.
You have to authenticate with your fingerprint when you use your loyalty card or your credit card?
With the Apple Wallet, yes, for the credit cards. With Google Wallet, you don't have to. It might be possible to set it up, I forget. But.
And the loyalty card?
No, you're just presenting it as a barcode for them to scan with their little phaser.
So the loyalty card you could actually just set up as a series of pictures in an album in your photo app.
No, well, you could do that, but it's in the wallet as well. Sorry, it's in the Google Wallet as well. But on the iPhone, it's in a separate app. But you could do it in the photos as well. It's just an image of a barcode that they're using. because no loyalty cards I'm aware of have a chip. They're just barcodes. But there's probably one out there somewhere.
Okay, so moving along, Stuart, you've got a thing on Rebe here.
Oh, yes. More shopping. I've been using the Rebe app for quite a while and like it very much. And turns out they've been using the search engine or whatever they call it from something called Flip for the last little while. And ultimately, Rebe is going to become Flip or be absorbed by Flip or whatever. They flipped the Flip is essentially the same thing. It's a collection of store flyers, and you can pursue the current flyers or look up the latest flyers and what's coming, and select items to plug into a list. And there's no real major differences between the two, except the buttons are in different places. You have to get used to a different interface. You know, it's like between Windows 10 and Windows 11. They've moved the damn button to do this, so you've got to find it. Rebe, you didn't need a password. If you set up an account with them, they just took an email address and would send a number for you to your email address that you would have to enter to validate your account if you were logging in for the first time or had logged out. Flip, you set up an account with a password, and it syncs across all your devices that will accept it. I've got it on Android, iOS, and Windows at the moment. Haven't tried it on the Chromebox, but yeah. So I don't know when Flip is going to, or when Rebe is going to disappear, but I assume it's going to happen soon. So if anyone out there is looking and using one of these shopping apps and haven't yet, I would say go straight to Flip and figure out the interface there. It'll save you a little grief down the road when you're forced to make the switch.
Okay, thanks, Stuart. And for people who are interested in this stuff, there's a whole raft of comments, some good and some bad, in the chat window. So I take a look at those.
I better mute myself before I do that.
Okay, so our next item is a question that came in from Serge Ri, and Chris is going to chat about this.
I'm going to. That's fine. I think I can, but I didn't really know the solution to this. So Serge Arik was looking for a way to export or convert the conversation that happens in, like, the chat window in Microsoft Teams to get it into Word or PDF document or something like that. And he did some searching on it, and he came to the conclusion that from everything he read, that it's just actually not possible to do that. And so he wondered if anybody actually has figured out a way to do it. So next.
Yeah, sorry, Chris. I recognize that I didn't give the answer, so I thought it must be you, but it turns out it's actually Harvey.
So Harvey actually responded to this. It went up as a question in the forum, and Harvey responded to that, and he said, try this, and he says, open up the Teams into the browser, and then select all the conversation. And then, so you can do that with the mouse or just shift click from the start to the end to select it all. And then right click and select print as a PDF. And it should save all of the text that is captured there into the PDF. So I don't know, Serge Eric, if he's on the call tonight. Yes, he is. Serge Eric, have you tried that to see if it'll work for you?
Yes, I've tried that, and usually what happens is only the page showing that is copied and transferred.
Okay.
Same thing with the Outlook. If you transfer to Outlook, there's a way to transfer to Outlook. It's the same thing. It's not the whole conversation, like the whole thing.
Have you tried
parts of it?
Yeah, have you tried like hitting Control A or something like that?
Oh yes,
off?
Oh yes.
Yeah, okay.
Oh yeah.
Okay. So yeah, I was sort of surprised that it was this simple to do, because I know that some of the things that you searched on was in forums where people were pretty knowledgeable about it and they were saying no, can't be done. So it sounds like we're still in a position of no, can't be done.
They're saying that it's Microsoft should be working on that right now.
Yeah.
Have you put something in the feedback hub? I'm sure that will get you an instant response.
Actually, I do suggest that you go into the feedback hub. I bet you there's already stuff there. And if you upvote it, the more upvotes that something gets, the more likely it is to go to the attention of Microsoft to actually think that this is something worthy of putting their resources behind. So I do actually suggest that people do. I don't know how effective the feedback hub is, quite frankly, but it's the one avenue that people do have that Microsoft says they listen to. And so I do encourage people to actually go into the feedback hub.
That sounds like a feature that they really should implement.
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
Yeah. To me, it's that's absolutely a no-brainer to get the text out of it.
You know, the problem we have is at work, we were told that I work for the government of Canada, and when they have an ATIP, access to information requests, they were going through emails and emails and emails of people. Now they told us, well, transfer a lot of the conversations to the Teams. That way, when we look at the emails, it's going to be easier. And now they're telling us that Teams, we will only keep 1 month of conversation there.
Oh.
But we have our team has precious stuff in there, and we want to keep it.
Oh boy, yeah, for sure. Okay, well, if anybody else comes up with anything, we can certainly entertain it in a future Q&A.
One suggestion would be, I don't know if it's possible. I've never used Microsoft Teams, so bear that in mind. But if you could reduce the size of the font to way, way down, and then select all, and then copy it into a text file or a Word file, and then enlarge the text, then that might be a way of capturing more, at least.
Yeah, I don't know that the chat window in Teams is sizable fonts.
Not sure. I'll try it, though, if it's possible.
Yeah, interesting.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay, moving along, we have an update from Chris. This is really from Chris.
Yeah, this is really for me. Yeah. This is about Tunnel Bear VPN. So we've talked about VPNs a number of times at Q&A and various other venues. Just a reminder, a virtual private network, what it does is it takes all the traffic going from your computer to the Internet, and it puts it into an encrypted tunnel that goes to the VPN server, and then it goes from that VPN server to the final destination. And what it does is it prevents sniffing of the traffic between your device and the VPN server, because that's an encrypted tunnel that is, you know, nobody else can see what's going on except you and the VPN server. And then it is also often used to for avoiding geo-blocking. And the reason is that your traffic goes to the VPN server, whatever country that happens to be in. When the traffic ends up at the final destination server, it looks like it came from that particular country. So it gets around geo-blocking. Different times we've talked about it, a lot of ones there. So Tunnel Bear VPN is actually not a bad VPN. It was based in Toronto. I like that quote from PC Magazine, a serious VPN that doesn't take itself too seriously. There's all kinds of bear references to when you do things. It was created in 2011 and was actually acquired by McAfee in 2018. I didn't know about that until I started digging in a little bit more. You can connect through 48 different countries, so you can appear to be in any of 48 different countries. You cannot locate within a specific country. Some other VPNs allow you to select, say, a city or something like that. This one is just, it's going to be a country. It does allow you to have unlimited devices, and it has clients for Windows, Android, Mac OS, and iOS for phones. They say there's limited support for Linux, and I don't know exactly what that means. A free account, and this is what the update is really all about, is the free account allows you 2 gigabytes of traffic per month, and that's up from 500 megabytes that was previously. I think this is a pretty recent change that they jumped 2 gigabytes. And you can actually get an extra 1 gigabyte for the current month just by tweeting about it. And you can do it every month, and you'll get an extra gigabyte for free. So potentially you could be actually getting 3 gigabytes of traffic per month. If you do pay for it, there's an unlimited account. 1 month would be $10. This is U.S. 1 year, it drops to $5 a month. Or if you go for a 3 year, it drops to $3.33. Per month for that account. So I find it actually works quite well. I use it to evade geo-blocking, and I don't use it for, you know, its encryption capabilities, but it does work quite effectively for geo-blocking. In fact, I was able to start using the Bard AI search engine, which is currently not available in Canada, by just using TunnelBear. And firing up Bard, it thought I was in the United States and would happily allow me to use its AI search engine. So that's the update for TunnelBear. I encourage anybody to try out free account. It works easily, simply, and I think a lot of people, even 2 gigabytes a month, is probably going to cover off an awful lot of usage on it.
Chris, does that two gigabytes per month, does that apply to current subscribers, as opposed to just new users?
Yes, it should be, because I had an account already, and I downloaded the client onto this new computer, and it's showing as having 2 gigabytes available.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. There is a comment about the Opera browser giving free VPN. That's true. It's only in the browser. Whereas the TunnelBear is a true VPN, so all of your traffic will end up going through that encrypted tunnel. Whether that's good, bad, or indifferent is up to you to decide. But yeah, I use the Opera browser VPN quite frequently as well. But this is kind of nice that it just works in, you know, whatever browser I'm using or whatever program I'm using will use the encrypted tunnel.
Yeah, but the trick is you have to start the TunnelBear app before you actually go to the browser, right?
Yeah, you get a tray icon, and so currently it's just looking like a pipe that is empty right now on mine, and that's saying that the VPN is off, and all I have to do is click it, and then it will connect, and or I can go into the menu and choose a particular country, and it will then connect. And then the icon changes to show you that the TunnelBear is active. And then if you want to turn it off, you just click the icon again, turn it off, and you're back to your normal traffic pattern.
So Glenn's asking if there's a way to track the data through TunnelBear so you can stay within the 2 gigabytes per month.
Yeah, it will tell you how much you've got available. Like right now, I just clicked the icon, and it came up and it's saying I've got 1903 megabytes. So I've used, you know, even in my testing here, it used less than 100 megabytes in what I've used this month so far. And so, but I don't use it often. But yeah, that dialog box will tell you how much you've got remaining in the current month.
If you have separate accounts, you could use a separate account for each device you have. So you'd get 2 gigabyte for your phone, 2 gigabyte for your computer. Is that so?
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, you could do it that way rather than sharing the account across devices. Just set up a different account and use it on a just device by device basis. Yeah, that'd be smart.
Jeff saying a strong VPN has unlimited data at great prices, plus 256 gigabytes of cloud storage, $18.25 US annually. So anybody who wants to pay for it, there's an option for you.
Very suspicious. Also, VPN doesn't assure necessarily all your privacy. What it means is that other people, your ISP cannot see what you're doing. Or if you're at a cafe or something, they can't see what you're doing, or people that are in the cafe can't see what you're doing. One question I would have with TunnelBear is, what is the bandwidth on TunnelBear? Is it suitable for video, or is it more suitable for browsing and such?
I haven't actually done any testing on that. I'll report back next month, because it'd be easy enough just to fire up the VPN and then do a bandwidth check against Sierra or something like that. So I'll report back next month on how that works. But I didn't notice any real significant slowdown or anything like that. It just seemed normal to me. But I will do that test. Good point.
Okay, so we're well within the last 10 minutes. So if anybody has any questions that we haven't answered already, now is the time to put them in the chat window or open your microphone and ask away.
I have a problem.
I have a Lexmark printer on my wired network, and it doesn't want to print. I run the troubleshooter. It says there's nothing wrong, but it prints. And it seems like I have to run the troubleshooter all the time. It says that it's online. Anybody got any ideas?
So just by running the troubleshooter allows you to print?
Yes, it says there's no problem.
and then it'll just at some point in time, it just decides not going to print anymore?
Well, I haven't tested it extensively. I've been trying to do some prints tonight. And I've had to run it kind of every time to get the queue to empty, the print queue.
I have a similar problem. It doesn't happen all the time. It's totally random. And if I run the troubleshooter, it works. It's the same. It won't let me scan sometimes. And I run the troubleshooter, and then I have to print one page, and then it works.
It's strange.
Yeah, those are bizarre symptoms.
And I tried reloading the HP, I tried a number of things. Nothing seems to work except running the troubleshooter. And it always says you have to talk to the admin, but then it doesn't seem to matter. It works.
I wonder if just stopping and starting the print spooler service, whether that would actually do it as well. That might be a simpler solution. You could actually do it from a batch file. I can, let me come up with that, and I can report back for next Q&A on how to stop and start the printer service. I don't know if it'll help, but.
The other, if you're talking about the service,
which I hadn't considered, it may be that changing the services you can have start automatically, start delayed, start manually. Maybe changing between those might work. I'll have to try it out.
Yeah, that's true.
Is that a network printer you're talking about?
Yes, it's on my gigabit network.
Is it tied to a particular machine, or is it?
Yes, one machine.
Is that machine have a static IP address or DHCP?
Yes, I said it is static.
Because that would have been my suspicion that it was DHCP. So.
No, that's a possibility, I think, in some instances.
Question. Sorry, go ahead, Chris.
Tom, I know you know how to do it, but who was it who was saying they were also having a problem? B?
That was me, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to put into the chat, just while this carries on, I'm going to put into the chat how something else you can try, and this would just be stopping and starting the print spooler. And if it happens to work, let me know, because that one I can report next month or next week for sure with a batch file that you could just, you know, put it on your desktop or on your taskbar and just click it. It would stop the service, start the service. And if that works, I mean, it's not the greatest solution. The greatest solution is it works properly, but a one-click fix for it might be useful. So I'll put this into the chat.
Okay, that's great. I'm not 100% sure I know what you mean by starting and stopping this.
That's what I'm going to put into the chat right now.
Awesome. All right. Thanks. I'm not as literate as all you guys. I just futz around and hope for the best.
It's basically the print spooler, which is a Windows feature. It's a Windows service. So what you do is you stop the service, clear the print spooler, start the service, and everything should work.
Right. Okay, that actually makes sense. Okay, that's great. Oh, I look forward to that.
So there was there's a question in the chat here, Chris. Would using a VPN at a coffee shop be safer than doing online bank transactions just using an HTTPS connection?
Personally, I don't think it's a big deal. When you're using something like a bank, you are over an encrypted session. They're not going to allow you to do a session without it being an encrypted session with a bank. I mean, there's just no bank in the world that is going to allow you to do that. So you're already with an encrypted session that is going to the bank. Do you want to double encrypt it? A VPN would double encrypt it. I think the encryption itself in the browser is more than adequate, personally.
In fact, all of
the HTTPS connections you have on your browser or in other places are also, they would be doubly encrypted, so they wouldn't be visible to the VPN provider or your ISP.
Martin says he's using NordVPN when he's out of the house, and he's run into problems with OnRoute and Tim Hortons. And NordVPN suggests it's something related to Rogers in these locations. Anybody had any similar issues?
Hey, Alan, that was me, Karen.
Oh, sorry.
Responding to Martin.
My guess.
I've talked to my bank about the fact that they only have a fairly short password, and they said, well, they checked the IP and so on. So some problems authenticating when you have to try to log into someplace, maybe due to the fact that you're logging in from a different IP, and it's even worse if the IP is out of the country. You may have troubles with a VPN. Because of that,
you absolutely will have trouble with the VPN doing banking. I made the mistake of leaving mine on, and then, first I did some online banking, and then I was doing some streaming from the U.S., so I was logged on to a Chicago VPN, and then I thought, oh, darn, I forgot to pay the hydro bill, and I logged back into my RBC, but because my location had changed from presumably Sudbury to Chicago, the bank locked me out. Now, to turn my account back and my card back on, I wasn't even able to do it over the phone. I had to go in person to the bank and have them turn it on there. They wouldn't do it over the phone. So. The original question about using a VPN to do something like banking at Tim Hortons, I would say absolutely not. Unless you choose the location, if the VPN had a location where you're at.
Okay, well,
the last thing in the chat that I have from to stop and start the print spooler service, that block of text, if you do that, that will be how you can do that.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, well,
I'm just copying it now.
Okay.
We had one additional item tonight, which we hadn't got time for, so we'll postpone that till next week. And it's all about backup power systems, so we hope there's no major storm between now and next week. Anyway, our May meeting is going to be members' favorites, and this is you, your favorite. So what applications, what hardware items have you bought and can't live without? What operating system tweaks have you made that everybody should be using? Anything computer related, if you have a 10 to 20 minute presentation, let us know, because we are looking for speakers for May the 10th. And before that, next week is our next Q&A, the 26th of April. So if you have questions or topics that you want to share at Q&A, send us an email to suggestion box as per usual. And we're a bit over time, so I hope everybody enjoyed that potpourri of stuff tonight. Thanks everyone who contributed, and we'll see you next week.
May the force be with you.
Yes. Thanks, folks. See you next week. I guess B probably got the stuff out of the chat. She's gone, so hopefully she got it down. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll write up a quick follow-up on that, mm-hmm. how to create a batch file that stops and starts the printer service.
I have a sneaking idea that that's already in Q&A somewhere.
Oh, yeah?
I think we might have done it before.
Okay. Well, we can do a follow-up again.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean,
it'll just take a minute.
It's something that you never remember how to do, so you need to be able to look it up somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. But that is a weird problem for the printer service to just sort of die. I don't know. That's odd.
Well, I've had my computer not be able to print, but that's because I didn't plug the printer into the laptop.
Yeah, that'll do it. I find wireless printing so often just fails for weird reasons and things like that.
I actually have that running now. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I have it running in both the Windows and Linux.
Yeah. Well, Linda, we got both her printers, her color laser and her monochrome laser. We got them both hooked up on the connecting. Well, actually, one of them is a wired connection to her router. And then she prints over the network. The other one is actually a wireless connection to her router. And both of them seem to be working, cross my fingers, tap on wood. Both of them seem to be working pretty reliably.
Yeah, I think that that batch file thing is really useful. I certainly had the situation where I printed a document and it hasn't come out of the printer. And it sits in the queue and won't do anything. You can't get rid of it. You can't. Yeah. But if you clear the print spooler queue, then you start over and everything works fine.
Yeah, that could be an option too, because in actual fact, just restarting the print spooler is not going to empty the queue.
Well, I always do both.
So that would be another thing then too. Can you do that in a batch file, that you actually clear the contents of the queue?
So.
Okay. Okay. I'll look to add that as well then, because that would definitely be useful. Because I've seen that before, where things will get stuck in the queue, and nothing you can do in the normal interface will actually get rid of it.
You can't fix it in a batch.
You may be able to fix it in a PowerShell.
True. Yeah.
So, yeah. And then also you may have to worry about admin rights.
You can do it in a simple batch file, is my recollection. I'm sure I did that before I knew anything about PowerShell.
This is probably before PowerShell existed.
It could well be. Okay, folks, thanks a lot.
Good night. Arrivederci.